From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We are no strangers to barbecue on this show. We have tasted, tested, and talked about the best ways to prepare it. And yet, you know what? There's still a lot to talk about, like whether or not true barbecue has to have sauce. Here's what happened when I asked Atlanta Barbecue Club president Bob Herndon that question last year.
Why do you ask the hardest questions in the world?
We got to settle this stuff.
I'm not going to settle these problems because Patrick Jones, who's the head judge of the Atlanta Barbecue Festival, does not like sauce. And he thinks true barbecue does not require sauce. He wants to just judge meat on its own. Some meat on its own. And I, as the head of the Atlanta Barbecue Festival, say I like meat with some sauce and some rub. Don't put it on for me. Let me put on the amount I want to put on. But I'm going to plead the fifth.
Today we have some little-known barbecue history for you out of Augusta. First, though, let's return to a segment on Southern food from last week. We talked about the 30th anniversary of White Trash Cooking. That cookbook stirred up a lot of controversy when it was first published. And food photographer Angie Mosier explained an unexpected reaction when some people read the book's title and learn about the subject matter.
We also, for some reason, feel like a sense of pride in it. You know, there's a lot of us that try to out-pour each other or out-country cook each other, out-soul food each other. It's like that Key and Peele sketch where they're bragging about who can eat the nastiest plate of food, you know, digs deep in the roots. So it's one thing. It's something that is a really hard conversation because some of us feel a little bit of pride in our white trash roots and some of us hate it.
Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Leslie Morris. I live in Macon, Georgia. I just wanted to say that when I was growing up in Atlanta, whole white trash referred to behavior, not poverty. Being poor didn't mean you were poor white trash. Poor white trash referred to vulgar or crude behavior. And I hate to hear it used in any other way.
We'd love to get your thoughts, so call us just like Leslie did at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and remember, we might feature your comments on the show. On any given day, there is probably a film or TV crew working somewhere in Georgia, but what are they working on? Let's go on set in Georgia.
Here we go. Movie!
Made in Georgia!
We make films.
Movies?
Let's go to the movies.
Let's go see the stars.
Atlanta Journal Constitution reporter Jennifer Brett is back with us. She writes the AJC's Atlanta Buzz blog. Always a pleasure to see you.
Good morning. Likewise.
So before we start on the film projects in the state, let's talk about a controversial programming decision coming from a Georgia-based TV network. Ever since sexual assault allegations surfaced against Bill Cosby from multiple women, many networks stopped showing reruns of The Cosby Show. Bounce TV was one of the networks that took Cosby Show reruns off the air. Bounce describes itself as the first African-American broadcast network. Its founders include Andrew Young and Martin Luther King III. But Bounce began airing The Cosby Show again. Why?
It's coming back in December, and they said that they have heard from their viewers who very much make the distinction between Bill Cosby, the man who was facing all of these allegations, and Dr. Cliff Huxtable, the fictitious character. And so they have done a very thorough study, it seems, of their viewers, and they do very clearly delineate between the factual person and the fictitious character he plays. So they're going to be bringing Cosby back to the air.
And then we'll be able to see ratings, whether or not people are actually watching.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what sort of critical reception this receives as Cosby returns to the air, as Bill Cosby is facing these allegations, of course.
At the very same time.
Yes, he faces trial regarding one particular incident, but then dozens of other women have come forward. You probably remember that New York Magazine cover of
all the faces.
All the accusers. And so this has been a very powerful moment in popular culture because, of course, you know, Bill Cosby is, you know, TV dad everybody loved growing up. And then all of these allegations come, you know, sort of trickle and then start pouring forth that have, you know, very much changed a public perception about him. He has a number of Atlanta connections, we should mention. He and his wife, Camille Cosby, at one time were the largest donors to Spelman College. They endowed a professorship donated $20 million in the late 1980s. Spellman has since severed ties with Cosby and returned the money, you know, due to these allegations. He's been stripped of a number of honorary degrees at schools around the country. So it's had a very huge repercussion in a number of different cultural realms.
So I would love to hear from all of you out there listening on whether or not you, too, separate the show, Cosby Show, from the man, and whether you're able to do that. If you're watching Cosby Show reruns, which were very, very popular for a very long time, you can reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or on Facebook. So without question, one of the most popular original shows on Netflix in the past few years is Stranger Things. Let's hear a little bit from last season.
She knows where Will is, and now she's just letting him die in the upside down.
Shut up!
For all we know, it's her fault.
Shut up! We're looking for some stupid monster. But did you ever stop to think that maybe she's the monster?
So a lot of people, including myself, very excited to see that Stranger Things got a second season. It is now filming in Georgia, and they're looking for extras. What do we expect from the second season?
Well, you know, if you watch the first season, and I don't want to give any spoilers, but oh my gosh,
yeah,
what a cliffhanger
it
ended on. So yeah, so people are just like sitting in front of their televisions going, come on, Netflix, let's come on with season two. It's been filming in the Stone Mountain area. Obviously, it's going to be a good woodsy area to film round two in. So Millie Bobby Brown has really become just, you know, the it girl. She plays 11.
Yes.
And, you know, we don't have time to go into why she's named 11. But anyway,
we don't. And plus, that's a spoiler.
Yes, exactly. But this has been just a huge, phenomenal success for Netflix. One of many projects that Netflix has been filming in Georgia. Another one that I want to mention is Jason Bateman's Ozark. This has been filming around Lake Allatoona. So if you've been like in Cherokee County Ball Ground, you know, kind of up north, you might have seen where they've turned, you know, restaurants into these fish camp looking places. That is for Jason Bateman's Ozark. It's unfortunate that we've had this drought as they've been trying to film near a lake, but hopefully we'll get some rain soon.
Be getting rain soon.
Fingers crossed.
Okay, so let's talk about, we're talking about what's filming both for TV and for film with Jennifer Brett of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Let's talk about one which is on a lot of people's minds right now, and that's The Walking Dead, now in its seventh season?
Yes.
Okay, so fans have been very traumatized this season by a new character that came on, Negan. He used a spiked baseball bat to strike fear into his enemies.
Buddy, you still there? I don't know. It seems like you're trying to speak, but you just took a hell of a hit. I just popped your skull so hard, your eyeball just popped out.
Okay, so that scene, I think, is a good example of what's turning people off.
Yeah, well, my colleague Rodney Ho pays very close attention to ratings, and just the other day he had a piece out saying that after opening with 17 million viewers in its season debut, the ratings had slid quite a bit and was drawing more like 11 million, which is still a lot, but you know,
but
by Walking Dead standards,
that's
a 35% dip. And like you noted, the season opener where Lucy the Bat is popping people's eyes out, it's like, oh, come on, man. You know, I read an interesting article right afterwards talking about, has The Walking Dead just become torture porn? Like, how many more dismemberments can we take here? And what narrative arc are we left with after not only the zombies, but we're you know, killing each other now?
Maybe it was just the natural arc, the life and death of this series. How long can you sustain a story that's always going to be about humans trying to survive zombies?
Yeah, and now, I mean, it was one thing when zombies were eating people, and that was, you know, obviously gory and disgusting, but when humans are popping each other's eyeballs out...
Why do you keep having to say that?
You know, it's really resonated with me. And now that you're going to be thinking about that all day, and I'm sorry, we're gonna
move on.
Yes.
I'll tell you what people are very excited about, including myself, and that is the Black Panther from Marvel.
Yes.
Chadwick Boseman will play the lead character. We first saw him in Captain America: Civil War, also filmed largely in Georgia. Boseman was on The Late Show with Seth Meyers, and he said that wearing the Black Panther suit while he's filming Atlanta was not easy.
There's a saying down south, when it's really hot, the devil is sitting in the corner. That means it's really hot. And we were shooting in Atlanta, Georgia, so we were close to where I'm from in South Carolina.
Gotcha.
In the midsummer, outside, when you stop a take, there are these tubes that run throughout the suit. You know, they hook you up to like a water pump system, so it runs through the suit. So you feel like you're wetting your pants.
So he has to suit up again, this time for the movie, the actual Black Panther movie that will center on his character. What do we know about this?
Yeah, this is going to be really exciting. And by the way, he is not kidding. I was able to watch a little bit of the Captain America Civil War filming downtown Atlanta. It was like a million degrees that day, and they're filming in this lot. There's not a blade of grass, a tree, any shade at all. And so God bless everybody involved with that project. Yeah, Angela Bassett, by the way, has just signed on to play Black Panther's mother in this new Marvel movie. It's also going to star Michael B. Jordan, Forrest Whitaker, Lupita Nyong'o.
Oh my God, you're just making me more excited.
I know, isn't it exciting? It's going to be directed by Ryan Coogler, known for Fruitvale Station and Creed. And so he reconnects with Creed star Michael B. Jordan for this movie. So I'm really excited about this one. It's going to be filming through about May of 2017. I've already started seeing casting calls for extras, and I'm posting those for you when I have a chance on AJC.com. So take a look and see how you can be part of this next Marvel project.
Okay, so let's talk about another movie that I'm really, really excited for. Atlanta singer Janelle Monáe will star in the new film Hidden Figures. She's joined by Taraji Henson and Octavia Spencer. It comes out next month. This is based on a true story. Three African-American women who played a big part in the development of the space program. And here's a clip from a scene. Taraji B. Henson and actor Mahershala Ali.
Pastor mentioned you're a computer at NASA. Pretty heady stuff.
Yes, it is.
They let women handle that sort of... That's not what I mean.
What do you mean?
I'm just surprised that something so taxing.
Mr. Johnson, if I were you, I'd quit talking right now.
Okay, you actually saw this film already.
Yes, I've seen Hidden Figures, and when it comes out, I want everybody to see Hidden Figures. There's going to be an early release in 2016 for Oscar consideration, and then wider release in 2017. Taraji P. Henson plays Katherine Johnson, Octavia Spencer plays Dorothy Vaughn, and Janelle Monáe plays Mary Jackson. These three women put John Glenn into space. They are, as the title implies, hidden figures, unknown to history until the book came out and then the film upon which the book is based comes out. When I got a chance to talk to Janelle Monáe, she was reading the script and thought it was so interesting and rich and wonderful. And her thought was, oh, how extraordinary that somebody's actually, you know, put a film in the 1960s and the black women aren't all maids and, you know, playing these stereotypical characters. Lo and behold, it's a true story. And she said at first she was really crestfallen that, you know, I've never heard of these women. And turns out, you know, a lot of people hadn't either. So what a wonderful opportunity to educate ourselves about this key moment in space
history.
Can
she act?
Yes. And her, I won't give a lot of spoilers away. Her character is Mary Jackson, a brilliant scientist, but also has a lot of fun, too.
And I mean, I have to reveal that before we started the conversation on air, you said you expect this to win Oscars in droves.
Everybody involved with this film needs an Oscar. I'm telling you what, it's extraordinary. By the way, it was filmed here. I should mention. So we're going to see downtown Canton, Georgia, and then also East Point and College Park. It was set, of course, in the 1960s, and so we have these, you know, nice old timey looking sets that are great. And so, you know, that's part of why we love the Georgia Film Industry, because it can look like any place.
That is Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Jennifer Brett. She writes for the AJC's Atlanta Buzz blog. Jennifer, thank you so much as always.
Good to see you.
Barbecue is a very serious subject here in the South, but its true history is not all that well known. Many barbecue cooks, original barbecue cooks, were enslaved African Americans in the run-up to the Civil War, and they were instrumental in creating the tastes and the methods that are still used today. Robert Moss is the contributing barbecue editor for Southern Living. He recently wrote about two of these cooks from Augusta for the website Barbecue Hub, and Robert joins us now by Skype. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how's it going?
First of all, I love that Southern Living has a barbecue editor. That's the best job ever.
it's not a bad gig. Yeah, you could do a lot worse than that.
How long have you been the barbecue editor?
I've been doing that for about 2 years now.
Okay, so also with us is culinary historian Michael Twitty. He's the author of the upcoming book, The Cooking Gene, and that's G-E-N-E. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning.
It's good to have you both with us. Robert, from the piece that you wrote for Barbecue Hub, it looks like you knew these cooks existed, even though you didn't know who they were. How did you know that? What told you that there were some unknown chefs out there?
Well, I wrote a book back in 2010 called Barbecue, the History of American Institution, that was really the first book that dug into barbecue history, you know, back before the 20th century, so back into the 19th century. And we we knew that there were African-American cooks doing most of the work, you know, from as simple things as pictures. If you saw pictures from the 19th century, you would see that the guys actually working on the pit were clearly African-American men. There might be a white guy sitting in the front who was the person who got all the credit, but the actual cooks we knew were African-Americans. But the hard part is that the names and the stories didn't make it into the documentary evidence, into the newspapers and things like that. So, in writing that book, I wrote about some of the so-called barbecue men who were all white guys, but wasn't really able to piece in information about the cooks until just recently.
So I heard you agreeing, Michael, when he was talking about these photos. And yet, why then does the myth persist that barbecue originated, some people say, in Eastern Europe?
I think it's, here's the deal. You have, for example, in Texas, where you have a lot of German and Czech influence, folks down there have combined. Our barbecue is always political, like all food is political. And folks have combined sort of like ethnic pride with, for lack of a better term, Eurocentrism and white supremacy. So a lot of things that originated in this Creolized mixture, I think Robert would agree that Europeans, Native Americans, and Africans all had their version of roasting meat. Africans and Native Americans particularly had the wood framework and the whole, and food being roasted in a hole, which is traditional barbecue as it was in the 19th century, particularly in the hands of African Americans. And Europeans had their own methods of roasting meats. So you can see how all these things came together in different parts of the South depending upon what ethnic mixture was around. But unfortunately, you have certain figures, and I won't name names, in South Carolina and Texas who have basically, taken African-American folk out of the picture historically, when actually it was all of these groups and all of their cultural elements that contributed. I might quickly say that, for example, a lot of people talk about the Caribbean. Well, who was in the Caribbean in 1502, the first arrival of enslaved Africans? And this was the part of Native America that was obliterated the most, in the onslaught of disease. So I shudder when people say, "Oh, just the Caribbean." No, it was this influx of people. I get in trouble in the Guardian saying that barbecue is freedom food. It's the freedom food of Maroons and rebel Native Americans who were fighting colonialism and slavery. And people didn't like that, even though we do associate barbecue with Independence Day and with Memorial Day and all these other freedom, themed festivals.
So, Robert, let's talk a little bit about these two men that you found. And I want to start with Pick Wells, because, wow, what a colorful life he had. Pick Wells cooked for the president, and it looks like reports said he died while he was cooking barbecue.
Yeah, that's apparently dropped dead next to the barbecue pit, which I suppose is probably somewhat fitting for someone who made his reputation.
While he didn't fall in the pit.
That's right. Yeah. So tell me about him and how you found records of him.
Well, the interesting thing is sometimes all you really need is a name. And in this case, I'm indebted to David Shields, who's a professor at the University of South Carolina, who turned up the names of both Pick Wells and Gus Ferguson in research for a forthcoming book that he's working on. David's been writing about what he's calling the culinarians, which are the sort of lost lost generation of great cooks in the South, most of whom were African American. And he turned up these two gentlemen in his research. They weren't able to make it into his book, but just having the names alone, I was able to then go dig back into the census records and basically piece together, something resembling their life stories, which is for me is something I wasn't able to do prior to this, because the names simply had been lost to history.
And was his, his story typical of some of these African American cooks at that time?
Well, it's hard to know for sure, because literally we are just now starting to uncover these stories. But yes, I think it was. I think that it's a case of someone who didn't this is in the Jim Crow South.
Yeah.
You didn't have a lot of other options, but You know, clearly a person of talent and energy who found a way that that he could make a reputation and a name for himself, in this case, cooking barbecue.
So then let me take that to you, Michael, because it appears that a number of African-American cooks were never named, but some of the storyline of it not being part of Black tradition came because when there were newspaper reports or invitations, they talked about the white men as being the caterers or the managers. Mm-hmm. Why?
Because African-American folk prior to the end of the Civil War were property. I mean, on occasion, we know, for example, that through runaway ads, freedom seekers, we don't call them runaways, call them freedom seekers, were, listed by name as cooks, and they were talked about as, so-and-so is a great cook, I need him back in a hurry. Reward. Or sale ads, Charleston, Richmond, Baltimore, New Orleans, cooks are named. They say things like a complete cook, a master at the fire, an expert pastry cook. So those are the only times we see names associated with cooks other than letters and maybe journals. And, on occasion, sometimes some of these, sides for these barbecues would have reference the enslaved person, but almost never. So we were considered the machinery. And unfortunately, in the politics of writing about barbecue, there was a book in 2013, was it, Robert? I think it was. And a fella wrote about enslaved folks in the South and basically used the same kind of terminology. He wanted to rescue barbecue from, he said that making reference to these enslaved cooks was basically, we had northern white people to blame, and that it was really the genius of these white caterer overseers and not the enslaved cooks that produced the barbecue. He basically said that we were just like any other kind of machinery that did a task.
So, Robert, do we have a clue, and we're going to talk about Augustus Ferguson next, but do we have a clue about how these men actually cooked? I mean, in other words, what their style of barbecue was?
Definitely do. The things we think of as barbecue styles today, the Texas style, the South Carolina style, it's very much a 20th century thing. That was really created by the rise of restaurants in the early 20th century. 19th century barbecues are pretty consistent. Every account you see, whether you're in Virginia, you're in Texas, these are big pits dug in the ground, wood burned down to coals, and then whole animals placed over the pits. And we think of beef as being Texas today, and pork being, a Carolina thing. But back then it was basically whatever you had on hand. And in terms of sauces, it was the meat would be basted with a sort of vinegary pepper sauce, but there it really wasn't served with a sauce. So I think we have a pretty good sense of how the meat was cooked. It was cooked on, open pits in the ground and basted. That was a pretty consistent thing in the 19th century.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Southern Living Barbecue editor Robert Moss and culinary historian Michael Twitty. We're talking about some of the unknown barbecue masters. And Robert, how many are you still looking for?
Well, I'm looking for all of them, actually. Though, really with Pickens Wells and Augustus Ferguson, those are the two. At least of the African American barbecue cooks, I've been able to find the most information about. But we know there's hundreds, if not thousands, of others to be found. So we're still trying to find as many as we can.
And one of the things that you point out, Michael, when you're tracing the roots of barbecue, is that even the name has its roots in Africa. What do you mean?
So it's interesting that barbecue has a really weird etymology. You can go with barbacoa, which is, Taino Arawak Carib from the Caribbean. A Spanish corruption of an indigenous word meaning, a framework of sticks you cook on. Or you can go with the pseudo-French one, from the head to the tail. or you can go with babake. Now, babake is a Hausa term, and it's from northern Nigeria. And the Hausa were enslaved across the entire period of the transatlantic slave trade. They were traders, and because they were traders, their words, their language, enters into the language of many other West African peoples, despite the fact they have different language groups, etc. So babake literally means to build an incredibly big fire in order to cook. It means to singe. You change the tones. It's a tonal language. You change the tone. It means to singe the feathers off a fowl. It means to use up a lot of wood extravagantly in your cooking. Well, what would you use that for? It also means to roast, to grill, or to toast, and reference being a whole animal. So how interesting is that? And all the connotations of Southern barbecue are there. And, you know, we talk about the hot peppers and the vinegar. Well, in West Africa and most tropical places, why would you put hot peppers in your food? Is it just because you like spices, or the explanation we always hear is, well, if you sweat, you get cooler. Part of it's because of, you know, parasites. They keep down parasites in your body.
Right.
So it's medicinal as well as seasoning as well as, you know, whatever cooling effect. I've never felt it. supposed to be able to feel from sweating. But the vinegar as well. I mean, the vinegar and the pepper, if you can imagine animals that are in tropical regions where spoilage is almost immediate.
Yeah.
Those two things paired together work very nicely to sort of temper any sort of parasites or pests that may make spoil your food.
So, Robert, let's go then to Augustus Ferguson, who it appears immediately left his service at a white man's house and became a cook. Was that typical, that they would actually be able to make a living cooking barbecue?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know that we have enough information to say for sure, though there's certainly
we don't actually know what is typical and what isn't.
Yeah, that's true. We're still figuring it out, though it's consistent with patterns that, you know, as we start to dig into sort of the history of cooks in the South, that you see you know, where domestic service, you know, working for a white family was often, you know, the only way to you know, to make a living for a lot of folks in the South. But there's a consistent pattern of people doing that for a long while, and then when they're able to, going lighting out on their own. In the barbecue history there's a great WPA, Works Progress Administration, interview from the 1930s with the owners of a barbecue restaurant in Athens, Georgia, who started out doing exactly that, working as cooks and maids, you know, for white families in Atlanta. And then when they were able to, they opened up their own restaurant, because it's a you know, it was one of the early ways that you know, in the Jim Crow South, African Americans could actually achieve some level of independence and working for themselves. And so I think you see that with Gus Ferguson. He worked with, you know, basically being the cook for Charlie Bowler, the great white caterer around Augusta, achieved his own reputation. And then he started working as a cook at Jansen's restaurant in Augusta and still cooking barbecues. And then at some point, you know, ended up moving to New Jersey. And, you know, the record, I couldn't find too much about his life in Red Bank, New Jersey, but he did move up there with his entire family. He owned his own house, and he worked as a cook at a local restaurant. So I think it's sort of this progression toward independence, which you see consistently through those, you know, those few figures that we're able to find for the 19th and early 20th century.
So we only have a minute left, and I hate to do this to you, Robert, but what's the need to trace these men's life? Why do we need to know this?
I think it's you know, when I think of history, I just really want to know what really happened. You know, I don't want to create some mythic view of the past and try to make ourselves feel good. I think it's really just trying to as much as we're able to understand, you know, here's how things really worked in the past, and here's really the way the, you know, the way the barbecue tradition evolved. I don't think it does any of us any favors to sort of try to make up something that sounds good. I think it's much better to dig back into the past and, you know, use the facts to figure out how it actually happened.
That is Southern Living Barbecue editor Robert Moss. Also, we spoke with culinary historian Michael Twitty. Michael's author, also author of the upcoming book, The Cooking Gene. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
We've talked before about the dangers of fake news, and in a time when so many headlines are just made up out of nowhere, many people have shown their support for serious journalism with subscriptions to major outlets like The New York Times, The Washington Post, and NPR. Tomorrow, we'll talk about an icon of journalism right here in Georgia, and I'd love to have you be part of that conversation. Tell me, what was the best piece of journalism you've ever seen or read or even heard on the radio? You can call us at 404-500-9457 to tell us about a piece of journalism that has stuck with you over time. And then be sure to join us Tuesday at 9 a.m. for more. A conservative action group has created a watch list. It's aimed at naming professors who, quote, advance leftist propaganda, unquote. There are nearly 150 professors on that list from institutions all across the country. And one of them is Emory philosophy professor George Yancey. He joins me now over the phone. Hi, George. George, you with me? Also on the list is University of North Georgia English professor Matthew Bodie. He's on the phone as well. Hi, Matthew.
Hey there.
And to talk about watch lists in general is Dr. Corey Walker. He's a scholar of humanities and African American studies at Winston-Salem State University, and he joins us via Skype. Hi, Corey.
Good morning.
So, do we have George?
I hope so.
Okay, good. Now I can hear you. I wanted to start with you, George, because it feels like you almost weren't surprised by this. And by that, I say that it appears you've gotten a lot of hate mail and unwelcome messages since you published an editorial in the New York Times. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So I published an article called Dear White America. Yeah, yeah, Dear White America. And it was written, in which I say it's written sort of with love and concern, but it's written with a certain kind of courageous speech, and I had expected a certain kind of courageous listening. And it turns out, right after its publication, I received a lot of hate mail. The alt-right media picked up on it, and I got physical email, so I got messages, just a ton of messages that were just, I mean, saying things that I can't repeat, obviously. But very vitriolic. And what was interesting, again, alt-right, and what was interesting is that on their websites, after they called me the N-word, let's say 100 times, they would have this image of Donald Trump saying, go Trump. So in many ways, I wasn't surprised. And in fact, there's a piece, there's a little snippet from that article that Turning Point USA actually cites.
Now, you mentioned Turning Point USA because that is the group that's behind this new website. Turning Point USA is a group for young conservatives. It was founded by a 22-year-old. And that guy, Charlie Kirk, argues that American campuses have become hostile to Republicans. And this is what I wanted to bring up with you, Corey, before we talk to Matthew, is how typical is this complaint of a watch list, a watch list being one that looks for political dissenters or people from the other party? Is that typical?
Well, it has been typical since the 1990s. What you're looking at is a transformation. In the 1950s, of course, with the House Un-American Activities Committee and the crackdown in the McCarthyite era on political dissent, you had a number of scholars who began to study and began to engage in the political affiliations of professors. That sort of scholarship, Larzafell's study of 1958, has gone the way to a much more partisan and much more divisive sort of activity on the right. And you see this in the 1980s, 1990s, where you're looking at the politicization of campuses, where folks are assuming that a political party of a particular professor then automatically means that the university is indoctrinating students. It's really a method that the right has used to not only build its movement as part of organizing, but it's also part of how to get actual attention in the media. And when you're looking at this new group, it's a young group, recently started with a young charismatic leader. This group needs to get more attention. This is the proper way to get attention in this manner, and it's been part of
it sounds
the
like you're saying we shouldn't be talking about it.
Well, You have to talk about it because it comes up in a particular moment where watch lists have political consequences. And that has been since its inception in the 1950s. But this particular group is one that's using it just to mobilize folks and to organize itself. And it's done a horrific job at it. It isn't even included folks on the right as part of it. There were a couple of professors at the University of Chicago that were included. And once those individuals were included, and it became known by the organization, they were immediately taken off. You can even look at the Chronicle today. Folks are being taken on and off as soon as they're put on. And I have a colleague here at Winston-Salem State University who's on this list, and the information there is absolutely wrong.
So then that brings us to you then, Matthew Bodie of the University of North Georgia. You teach English there. Were you surprised to see your name on this list?
No, because, I mean, my role in fighting the campus carry bill in Georgia here has been going on since it started last spring, and that's why I was befuddled by the mission.
The campus carry was the bill that would have allowed the carrying of firearms on public schools, including universities.
Yes, and vetoed by the governor. Like I said, if the purpose of this particular website is to expose people, I've exposed myself, you know, far before this website was created, so I was kind of surprised to be on it. And like the person just said, the website is inept and kind of silly, if not for the fact that it's hearkening back to many other dangerous things. So I wasn't surprised, no.
So, George, let me read you a quote from one of the guys. Matt Lamb is with Turning Point USA. He's the Director of Constitutional Enforcement and Transparency. And he says, "We just want students, parents, alumni to know what's going on. So if an alumni is thinking of donating to a school, they may want to know where their money is going if they believe or agree or disagree with the professor's views." George, what response did you get from the administration at Emory?
When I published Dear White America, I actually got a lot of support from my colleagues, from students, and from upper administration. And from what I've heard, again, I've only gotten news from my colleagues, is that they are in fact backing me. So in the spirit of having backed me before, particularly from the president of the university, my guess is that they're also, you know, backing what I've said, because I've sort of, as I also outed myself. You know, it's not as if it's a secret in terms of the kind of pedagogical methods that I use and the topics that I discuss in my class.
We have this tweet from Nick Baum, who says, "Dear White America author, being disingenuous, controversy to his piece was that it was re-edited with his blessings."
Not sure I understand what that means.
I'm not either. That's why I'm posing it to you. Was your piece re-edited?
No, it wasn't re-edited. I wrote that piece for the first time. It was specifically written for The Stone in New York Times. And since that time, I've gotten a book contract, and that book is due to the publisher by February 1. But beyond that, it had never appeared before. I've spoken about whiteness. I mean, I teach a course called Critical Whiteness Studies. I'm one of the few philosophers of color, myself, Linda Alcoff, and Charles Mills, who have published on whiteness.
So let me put this to you then, Corey Walker. Some of the response to this watch list has been humor. There's a tip-off form included at the website where students can report on their teachers, and a lot of people have been using that tip-off form. One person reported Jesus Christ, saying, quote, "This teacher hangs out with lepers, prostitutes, and criminals. He's not even American, and he doesn't speak English. He's anti-wealth, anti-death penalty, and anti-public prayer." What do you feel about that particular strategy, responding to it with basically derision?
I think it's appropriate in this sense. Everything that goes on in terms of anonymity, in terms of these sites where you can anonymously publish anything, and there's no accountability, no public accountability, no accountability to any legitimate institution, no accountability to the university. We should treat it in this manner. We should treat it in a manner in which individuals, where we don't take it into the core of the institution and then transform institutions in light of it, but also make fun of it. Human humor is an appropriate strategy. But we have to remember that these particular sites, these watch lists, are part and parcel of a political strategy, part of a political strategy that's meant to change public discourse, to actually transform public discourse, to change the questions that we're engaging, to move away from substantive engagement about critical ideas to a much more personal ad hominem attack mode that really does not enhance American democracy and really does not enhance citizenship. So humor is an appropriate strategy, but humor within its limits of understanding that these sites are attempting to shift and transform what we're talking about in the public and then make some critical decisions about these important institutions.
My guests are Emory Professor George Yancey and also University of North Georgia Professor Matthew Bodie, who both appear on this conservative watch list. And you just heard Dr. Corey Walker, professor at Winston-Salem State University. Matthew, were you worried to see your name on that list? All joking aside, does it concern you?
I think it concerned my family and colleagues more than it did me. I started this back in the spring about this one issue and did receive some threatening emails and reported them to campus police. And so it just kind of like makes you wonder, not specifically about my students or any other people on campus, but the nuts out there who are reading these websites. As a professor of rhetoric, I wonder, what is the purpose of this website? Do they have a donation link there? But other than give information, what exactly are they trying to do? Information is not neutral. So they're suggesting some action, but they won't name the action that they want these people to do other than to harass me, I guess. And if you take that harassment far enough, it leads to violence.
George, have you gotten more complaints since the watch list went up?
Yeah, I have. People have now gone back to Dear White America, and I've gotten hate mail since that time. And I'll pick up on this theme also. I mean, there's a way in which I was, some of my colleagues said, not here, but said, you ought to be proud. This is a wonderful thing, right? A badge of honor. But after Dear White America, I mean, I had to actually have police presence in my public talks. I mean, the FBI got involved. So I received tons and tons of hate mail and threats. As soon as I read about this, I pulled out George Orwell's 1984, and there's this line where it says, quote, newspeak was designed not to extend but to diminish the range of thought. And then I started thinking about McCarthyism, COINTELPRO, right? I started thinking about these things. And it is a bit threatening, right? I mean, after all, you know, people are reading this. People who are fanatic are reading this. And now, after post-Trump, you know, election, there's a way in which I think we ought to be afraid because people are trying to shut down creative thought, transgressive thought. And so I think that's something that one ought to fear.
So, Corey Walker, the obvious difference between this watch list and, say, the McCarthy list is that one was sponsored by the government and one is not. But what are the dangers in these kind of lists? Have these kind of things in the past ended up with bad consequences, either for people or for their careers?
Well, you have to remember that the House Un-American Activities Committee began its life in the 1930s investigating Nazi propaganda in the U.S. and then morphed in the 1940s and 1950s into what we think of, you know, synonymously with Joseph McCarthy and his antics in the Senate. But what these lists do and what these lists are designed to do, particularly with the advent of a conservative moment in American politics emerging in the late 80s, in the late 80s and early 90s, is actually curtail and diminish the range of thought that's available on American college campuses, as well as begin to challenge the regime of public discourse, to actually curtail what's acceptable. When you look at what's going on now, it is George Yancey writing about whiteness in the New York Times. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote The Souls of White Folk in 1910. And in a sense, what you're looking at, the difference between 1910 and 2016 is that the moment of that transformation is the ascendancy of a virulent conservatism that really wants to restrict and curtail the freedom that's going on in the universities. And these freedoms are coextensive with the diversification of the university, as well as the university being one of the last bastions of freedom of thought and freedom to engage very contentious ideas.
Well, then, okay, Matthew Bodie, there is a place on this website, as I mentioned, where students can report their teachers. Do you think that you will be affected by this? Will you change your teaching style or subject matter?
Oh, not at all. I mean, last semester I did a course on the rhetoric of higher education. We spent a week on campus carry. I had students write about that issue on the pro carrying the gun side, and I wasn't biased toward their grades in any manner. I know I won't change the topics that I cover and the way that I teach. I think it just makes us more aware, more hyper aware of the entire situation that is education. I was going to suggest, you know, I always invite people into my classroom and take classes and get an education. But these particular websites don't seem to want to engage in learning. They cite other people like themselves and become circular in the sense that, no, I'm not going to change what I do. And I hope that the definition of education becomes not just citing other people like you, but learning and changing what it is you think is the previous person just said, it's kind of a freedom of thought. The other side doesn't seem to be interested in freedom of thought in that regard.
Well, we only have about a minute, less than a minute left, George, but are you going to change anything about...
Yeah, thanks for asking. Absolutely not. But I fear that, because, look, I'm tenured and I'm a full professor, right? So there's a way in which I'm not afraid in that sense of losing my job. I am afraid of my physical safety by those who take on these ideas and are very fanatic. But someone who's untenured, let's say a junior professor, it might. Oh yeah, there you go. Oh right, well good. You are speaking with a great deal of courage then. And if you think about, look, the etymology of education, educare, which means to lead out, right? I mean, it's precisely our job. It's our telos to engage students in critical ideas that challenge them and that upset the status quo. You know, but at one level, I think that, you know, if we're not careful, it's going to have the sort of impact that philosopher, you know, Jeremy Bentham's, his notion of panopticon, which is basically, you know, this idea that we begin to surveil ourselves. And I think for many, it might have that impact. But again, I'm secure in some kinds of ways.
Lucky you. Yes, Emory philosophy professor George Yancey. We also spoke with Matthew Bodie at the University of North Georgia and Corey Walker, professor of humanities and African American studies at Winston State Salem University. Thank you so much to all three of you.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, Thank you.
That's our show for today. But give us your thoughts on this watch list. Do you think we should track the politics of people teaching in public universities? You know how to reach us on Twitter at OST Talk or on Facebook. You can reach me at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day.